Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. Lahav, did you read the Tehran Times this morning?
Yes, I think we should all be very afraid. We all have red pins on our backs.
What did you think of the of that map, right? We're talking about the Tehran Times Wednesday morning published a map with a bunch of red dots indicating, I guess, where the targets would be for a potential retaliatory strike by Iran against Israel if Israel were to attack Iran. But there was something interesting about that map, no?
Well, they were going to attack Shechem, Nablus, and Jenin, and also parts of Lebanon, which is interesting. You would think southern Lebanon is where their buddies in Hezbollah are hanging out, so I don't know why they want to attack there. But, you know, thanks for the help.
And the Gaza Strip,
yeah.
And the Golan Heights.
Yeah, whoever made that map is, geography is not their strong suit.
They might want to, unless they believe in greater Israel, right? They're part of the Bezalel Smotrich camp, which
right.
You can never know when it comes to Iran exactly what game they're playing.
Exactly. So, yeah, so this map is, it looks like it was like generated by Google Maps, you know, and what did they write? They wrote like, you can't hide, time is running out, you know, the... very ridiculous map.
Yeah, one wrong move, basically, and this is what will happen.
One wrong move, yeah.
It kind of ties in almost to a big story that you wrote on Tuesday of this week, which was about as I think one senior official called it, an obsession by the Biden administration about Israeli settlements. So if the Tehran Times thinks that all Israeli settlements are part of Israel, then, you know, I guess maybe we should thank them for that. But the Biden administration definitely is not looking at things along those same lines. And it seems that there's some increased tension right now between Jerusalem and Washington exactly on that settlement issue.
Yeah, and it seems to be specifically coming from the State Department, which I guess historically is not so surprising. But yeah, the State Department is putting a lot of weight on the settlement issue, so much so that some of my sources said that in a meeting between Gantz and Secretary of State Blinken last week, that Blinken wanted to dedicate equal amounts of time to the Palestinians and the settlements as he did to the Iranian threat. Which, you know, for Israelis, like, Iran is an existential threat. And the settlements are, you know, at least from Gantz's perspective, settlements are a problem, but not at that level, you know. And so a lot of people were shocked, I would say. I don't think they should have been so shocked, because I think all along Biden has been a very strong opponent of settlements. And so it's not a surprise that this administration would be coming out against it. But you know, I had several sources on that story that they just felt that the proportion is completely off.
But don't you think, Lahav, that the surprise is actually that they were, that Israel was at all surprised by this, right? In other words, Biden was the vice president to Obama. We know about Obama's position on the settlements. He was the one who pushed Netanyahu back in 2009 for an almost 1 year freeze and complete freeze on settlement construction. The settlements were always a thorn in the side of the Obama administration. Why would it be any different for the Biden folks, who are no less of members of the Democratic Party, are no less progressive, are no less liberal, and are no less opposed to settlement activity? And I think until now they've been giving a pass to Israel because of the fragility of the coalition, and they wanted to wait, as we knew, for the budget to pass. But once the budget passed, now's the time to start to crack down on these issues from their perspective, I think. So I'm surprised that Israelis are surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I do think at some level, Bennett thought that this coalition would give them like a lot of grace internationally. And maybe it gave them a couple months. But now this government's been in office for 6 months. And like, you know, him going around and saying, oh, look at, you know, how diverse my coalition is. Like, the people are not that they're not impressed, but like, it's not an excuse, right? And, you know, compared to Netanyahu, they're not doing so much in the settlements these days, compared to Netanyahu, at least in the previous 5 years or so. But yeah, I mean, the Biden administration is opposed to anything, really. So they're definitely, you know, swinging around their weight a bit and trying to get Bennett to slow things down entirely.
I know we kind of spoke about this last week, but I think that it's always interesting to me how Israelis are surprised that people around the world, and especially foreign government officials, bring up the Palestinian issue. It's almost as if we continue here in Israel to bury our head in the sand and pretend like the status quo is a long-term solution, the rest of the world will also start to accept that the status quo is a long-term solution. But they don't. and they never will.
Right.
And we need to realize that we need to come up with a plan. We need to think what we want to do. And Netanyahu didn't do it. And Bennett's definitely not doing it.
Well, Bennett, I remember when he first went into politics, like, he kept saying, like, you know, Israel has so much to offer. Why do we talk about the Palestinians all the time? We need to talk about other things. Now, he's right, like, a lot of, in the sense that a lot of the world does want to talk to Israel about high tech and agriculture and things like that. But, you know, people are able to multitask. And I think that he's a little bit, you know, needs to figure out how to do all those things at once. Because, yes, like, just because Israeli tech has given us, like, a world class name and a lot of countries are interested in that, they're not going to turn a blind eye to other things going on here.
On the point of Israeli tech, Bennett made a historic visit this week to Abu Dhabi, to the United Arab Emirates. You were supposed to go. But then late Saturday night, right, the prime minister's office canceled journalists' participation because of Omicron.
Yes.
And the continued restrictions that Israel is imposing on this country. We're going to talk about that in a bit in the context of the Miss Universe contest and competition that took place in a lot earlier this week. But that meeting in Abu Dhabi with the crown prince and the foreign minister and top Emirati officials was very much focused on ways to increase bilateral cooperation and partnership between Israel and the UAE, right? Including tech.
Yes. Trade, tech, research and development, these kinds of things were really central to the visit. And they were really, that was really everything in their public statements. I mean, you know, they were talking about that and maybe cooperating on health, also COVID, a little bit of culture. Bennett met with the culture minister. But behind the scenes, of course, Iran and security issues were a big thing as well.
Israel's idea here, right? And, you know, I'd love, we're going to talk with Loay al-Sharif, who's an Emirati social media activist and has become something of an Israeli UAE expert.
He lives in the Emirates. He's not actually Emirati.
He's not actually just Emirati, but he lives in Abu Dhabi. But we're going to talk to him about the feeling and the sentiment on the street in Abu Dhabi during the Bennett visit. But I'm curious, though, you know, Israel has this whole thing that we want to create this front against the Iranians. But on the other hand, we saw that, I think, was Sheikh Tahnoun, the national security advisor of the Emirates, who visited Tehran just a few days ago and held some high-level talks there. So what exactly is the strategy in the Emirates right now for Iran?
Well, it seems like the Emiratis are kind of hedging their bets. Iran is much bigger than the Emirates, and it's right next to them. And they're very nervous about Iran, you know, destabilizing the region. They're very nervous about a nuclear Iran. And so they've built up their military in recent years. But at the same time, they would rather not provoke Iran. And so they're kind of, you know, they're looking at the Vienna talks, which were, you know, continued this week and just are not going anywhere, really. And they see that and they say, okay, you know, we're not sure that the outcome of these negotiations is going to be good for us. So let's just be more on Iran's good side, which Israel doesn't have that option, right? Like, we can't be on Iran's good side, even if we tried. And so we still have to try to bring our allies on board with us. But UAE is trying to sort of play it both ways.
You know, I was at the IEC, the Israel American Council conference in Miami, sunny, beautiful Miami this past weekend. And Defense Minister Benny Gantz was there, and he gave us a briefing just before Shabbat came in on Friday. He had come back. He had come to Miami from Washington, where he had held those talks with Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin. And his answer to a question of when does he think that, or what's the American strategy, and is it going to culminate in a deal? Is it not going to culminate in a deal? His feeling is that in the next few weeks we'll know. And the feeling that I walked away with from that briefing was that Israel's assumption is that there's going to be a deal, and it's not going to be a good one, right? And I think that that's where we're seeing all the saber rattling coming from, is Israel saying, okay, we know there's going to be a deal. It's not going to be a good one, but we're still preparing for any eventuality.
Yeah, I mean, Israel is preparing for whatever could happen. This whole situation, will there be a deal or not? It's like the Europeans are really annoyed at the Iranians right now, because the Iranians are just, you know, have completely unrealistic proposals that would lift even more sanctions than they would have had now under the JCPOA. And the U.S. isn't actually in the talks yet, right? Like, at this point, it's the Iranians that are talking to the E3, which is the the UK, France, and Germany, as well as Russia and China. And the E3 keeps putting out all these messages saying, like, Iran is not taking this seriously. They're not bringing forward any realistic proposals. The Russians keep saying, oh, things are moving slowly, but they're moving well. We're making progress. And China is saying nothing. And the Americans are not really in the talks. They're just being updated, I guess, mostly by the Europeans, because that's who their actual allies are in the talks. But it seems like, yeah, the Americans really want a deal, even if the Europeans at this point seem to think that it's impossible. And both the foreign ministers of Germany and of the UK have been saying that time is running out. So if there ends up being a bad deal, it's like Israel on the one hand is considered, you know, Israel says all the time, like Netanyahu would say all the time, and now Bennett has said it as well, that Israel's not obligated to a bad deal. But on the other hand, like we want American support. Like an attack on Iran is not one and done. You know, it could probably bring about a war. I mean, we discussed this at length last week. And so there's not as much Israel can do if a bad deal is reached.
Right.
We're sort of, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, I guess it's one of those cases. A question on the trip, right? So you did not fly with the prime minister to the UAE, which might have been best in hindsight, because a security guard who had been on the flight seems to have come down with COVID, unclear if it's Omicron, but the delegation is still in quarantine a few days after returning to Israel and having to take, I think, 3 tests as opposed to the standard 2. But the other interesting part of that visit is that the Wings of Zion, right? Isn't that the name? Is not being used.
Yes.
Right. And this is a little ridiculous. So why don't you tell our listeners what the Wings of Zion are? It's not the Messiah flying Jews from around the world to the Jewish homeland. It's something else. But this is becoming a little insane, I think.
The Wing of Zion is the Israeli version of Air Force One. Israel has never had its own sort of plane for prime ministers and presidents. They would always just rent a plane. Or even, I know in some cases, President Rivlin just took a commercial flight and sat in first class. And so now this, in 2014, I believe, the government decided that there should be this plane. Finance minister at the time, Yair Lapid, really, really opposed it. But the government decided it. And since 2016, there's been work done on a plane. It was just a 20-year-old plane that was bought from Qantas, which is an Australian airline. It ended up costing hundreds of millions of shekels, but the plane now is ready. It's like a nice blue plane that says the State of Israel on it. And it has all kinds of secret defensive capabilities
and the ability to run the military from the skies if needed, right, and continue to operate the country,
right,
run the country,
right. That's, yeah, so there's like a mini prime minister's office in there where, you know, he has the red telephone and all of the secret,
like Air Force,
you know, lines,
One, right?
And things,
like what Americans, exactly, know of being Air Force,
exactly,
One.
And you know, and enough space to take the press in the back, also what you see in the movies on Air Force One. But the problem is that nobody is using it. Technically, it's been ready since March, but last week it actually got the certificate saying it's ready.
So why is no one using it? What's the reason behind this?
At this point, it seems entirely political. It seems that the whole project is just strongly identified with Netanyahu. Lapid thinks that it's a symbol of corruption and that we don't need a special plane. I'll tell you, when this happened, when the government made this decision back in 2014, I actually wrote an op-ed in Hebrew about it. About how it's a very good idea and it is supposed to pay for itself within 5 years. It costs many millions of shekels to rent a plane every single time the prime minister flies somewhere, and often the president. And it just seems, not only because it's like the more respectable thing to do and that many, many countries around the world have a special plane, not only because of the convenience, which it makes it easier, you know, to actually run the country from the air, but also it's just makes more sense economically, I think. But politically, it's not happened.
There's something about this country, right? And I say this as someone who's lived here for nearly 30 years now, that we don't want our leaders to be comfortable, to have anything luxurious looking. It's as if we want them to suffer, right? And you know, there were all these stories back in the day when Netanyahu would fly places. He'd go off to meetings with Obama and he'd ask to install a bed
right
on the El Al chartered plane that his delegation would take, and people would go crazy. How dare he ask to install a bed? And to me, it was always ridiculous. Like, don't you want your leader who's landing in Washington, D.C., going straight to meetings, don't you want him to have a good night's rest, to be relaxed,
yeah,
to be fresh when he arrives? I mean, this whole concept of them suffering and having to charter these airplanes, they should have a proper plane. Israel's a strong country. It has a strong economy. It has plenty of money. It doesn't need to be like, look like a schnorrer when Israeli leaders are flying overseas. It's enough already.
Yeah, no, and I completely agree. And by the way, this plane does have like a suite, like with a bed for the prime minister to sleep, and also his senior staff, they have like a business class style seats that turn into beds.
Great. And they should, and we should be happy, and we should want them to have that. And all this populism is just, it's immature, it's ridiculous, and it's unbecoming of a country that wants to lead as if it's a technological master and one of the most sophisticated and advanced countries in the world. It's time for Israel to grow up.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
So, Lahav, just getting back to Omicron and to the continued restrictions, so obviously you didn't go with the prime minister to Abu Dhabi, and foreigners are still not allowed into Israel, including Jews who have strong ties here and family members, etc. But we did have a Miss Universe contest, right? So we definitely had lots of people from outside the country. They just weren't the people who, I guess, really wanted to come to Israel.
Right. It's like Steve Harvey can come and host the Miss Universe contest, but not, you know, the siblings or parents of people who live in Israel. So a lot of people are very frustrated about it in that respect. But also, you know, like feminist organizations in Israel were protesting. I don't think they were standing outside with signs, but they sort of put out statements and things saying, like, why is the government taking part in this? So like the tourism ministry, like subsidized all kinds of things. And I think it is an interesting question because on the one hand, it is in theory good for the tourism industry. I'm not sure in practice with COVID and everything, how much of an impact it'll have. But in theory, to have all these, you know, beautiful women from around the world posting all over their Instagrams of sites from Israel is, you know, good for Israel. But on the other hand, it's like, is that the message, is that like a good educational message that we want to send, that, you know, something that's basically based on the objectification of women should get government funding? And I don't know, I'm really of two minds about it, because like I grew up watching Miss America, you know, and I don't think that it made me, you know, hate myself or anything, you know, and I grew up and went to college and got a good job and everything. But on the other hand, like, it's certainly not something I would want my daughter to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
So I don't know.
I guess I might have to be a little more careful talking about this as the man on this podcast.
Right.
But I will just say, I completely hear you, but just playing devil's advocate for a moment, this is, I don't know how many viewers, right, but probably hundreds of millions of people from around the world watch this thing. It took place in a lot. It does do something to help portray Israel as a different type of country than one that's just about conflict. The objectification, I completely understand. As the father of three daughters, I agree that this is not exactly the role model that we would want to show our children. But on the other hand, as a country, I can understand. I'm not sure that the criticism of why these people are allowed and other people are not is well placed. I think that, you know, a country does have to make decisions that are on a national level. And this is something that is of national importance, right? To portray Israel differently. And letting a grandmother come in for her grandchild's birth, while that's extremely important and an emotional and a very significant milestone in those people's personal lives, it's not something that impacts a nation, right? And I think that might be the difference between these two events.
Yeah, for sure. But I also definitely feel for the people who are like, you know, why are we having a beauty contest and not letting in, you know, Jews from around the world? It's a very tricky situation.
Oh, no, I think it's ridiculous. Yeah. I think all these restrictions to an extent have become exaggerated and over the top. And
yeah,
a lot of them are unnecessary.
Yeah, I think so, too. And they're only adding more. I mean, they just said that they're going to require a green pass to go into malls, which, like, for me, like, I think about it And like, you know, I have two kids, and sometimes if I need to, like, a mall is a really good place to take a couple of kids when you need to kill an hour or whatever. And now I can't do that anymore. And it's just like, it's just an inconvenience, sure. But like, people end up losing money, you know, and the economy and things like that, because I'm not going to PCR test my child every time I want to take them to like a gymbury.
Yeah, no, the restrictions are continuing. And I think that Israel's continuing with this potentially, in my view at least, exaggerated, over the top policy of restrictions. But we'll have to wait to see. And I guess next week we'll have a better view of the continued spread of Omicron. But for now, we have a great interview with Lorai El Sharif, who is not Emirati, but lives in the UAE in Abu Dhabi, social media activist, and something of an expert on Israeli UA relations. Here we go.
We're here with our special guest, Lorai El Sharif, who is a social media influencer, activist, and an expert on Israel-Arab relations, to talk to us a bit about Prime Minister Bennett's visit this week to Abu Dhabi.
Well, thank you so much, Lahav, for hosting me, and Yaakov as well.
Could you tell us how that visit was received among Emiratis?
I would say that this visit was received super positively by the people and by the leadership. I see my friends were talking about this visit as it's something that would strengthen the relations between the UAE and Israel, because it's been like almost a year and a half since the agreements were signed. And now when the leaders show the people that that they are together. So I was talking with my friends. I was with my friends like last night, and we were talking about, wow, this is great. Now it should be, and I think it's going to happen. It should be now MBZ visiting Israel. And believe me, I can assure you that as so many people think, when MBZ visits Israel, the number of Emiratis that will visit Israel will be doubled, if not even tripled. So in short, it was very positively received.
You know, I wanted to ask, Lorai, the we've seen a lot of Israelis who have come to the UAE, particularly to Dubai. They love coming as tourists. As you mentioned, we haven't seen a lot of Emiratis who have come to Israel. But what was also, I think, very interesting is that none of this was made a secret, this visit by Bennett, right? The Israeli flags were out there. It was all over the press, photos, embracing. You know, there are ways for leaders to have these visits and to play it down, not to make it as public, not to make it as warm and you know, to make it as open. But MBZ, as well as the rest of the government and the royal family, did not do that. So I'm curious, the average person in the Emirates today, a year later after the Abraham Accords, now with the Bennett visit, they're so, everyone is just as accepting of these ties and relations?
Absolutely. I'll let you, I'll tell you something. So people that I see on the media, and I'm very aware of the social media influencers, the Emiratis here. And I tell you that they're all accepting. But just to give you one note, the number of visits from Emiratis, I know many Emiratis want to go to Israel, but it's not because of any political or any other concern other than just the travel restrictions that we have here because of the COVID. Because it's like you will be quarantined again. You will be like, you need to do two PCRs.
Right. Also important to note that Israel is not letting any foreigners right now into Israel. So that's also part of it.
Exactly. But I'm just talking about the previous period, or the recent previous period, like from that time until that. But of course you have Emiratis visiting, but not as we would expect, because, you know, the Emiratis are raised on the culture of following the leadership. So the leaders know better. And even if there is someone who doesn't see the benefit of having this peace with Israel, they would say, you know what? We love our leaders. We trust our leaders, and we will follow our leaders. And this is a good thing, Baruch Hashem. This is why we don't have any like foolish things happening there and there. And this is why the UAE and other monarchies survived the the Arab, what they call it, the uprisings and stuff like that. So the majority of the people I know were so accepting.
So what do you think, or what do people in the UAE see as the main benefit of having relations with Israel? You know, in Israel, I think a lot of the talk is about sort of shared defense goals, for example. But I think in the UAE, those kinds of things are not talked about as much. So how do people see it locally?
I tend to disagree with you. Well, people see the new Middle East has to be led by strong nations and strong people. And I believe that so many people see strategic ally in this region. One of my friends said, we don't need a police officer in the region. We don't need an American police officer. America is a great ally, but we don't need a police officer in the region. We and Israel can work together in this region. So I would say the benefits that they're seeing, that Israel is a strategic partner, and many things we can leverage from Israel in terms of technology, high tech, in terms of agriculture, in terms of so many things. If you count the number of MOUs signed between Israel and the UAE, crazy. In education, in R&D, in high tech. The last show, Dubai Air Show, that was in Dubai, Rafael and other Israeli companies were present here. They were demonstrating their defense or their technology. It's something that attracted so many Emiratis, but I believe it's all inclusive, not only defense, but defense, education, technology, high tech, so many things.
I wanted to ask you about the relationship with the UAE. We know about Israel's interest in establishing a united front against Iran, and also there's obviously also Israelis' desire over years and decades to be accepted by other Arab countries throughout the region. And that's also what we saw come about through the Abraham Accords, and particularly this warm relationship now with the Emirates. But beyond the technology, beyond the defense relations, is there something deeper to these ties from the Emirati perspective?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that so many Israelis are visiting the UAE couple of months, and even in this month, and in the Hanukkah, in the Rosh Hashanah. Like, it's sometimes I walk in Dubai Mall, all I hear is Ima, 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 Ima. It's like, this is good. This is good for tourism. This is good for people-to-people connections and accepting and everything.
As long as it stays just Ima, 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 and it doesn't start to become other things, then you're okay.
of course, you're in a good place. So I was saying that the deeper thing that so many Emiratis see is that Israel and the UAE, or the UAE and its partners, can build a strong Middle East with all the countries coming along. And this is actually the way so many Emiratis see Israel, as a strategic partner. If you see the statements that are that come out from the presidential press, or from the official press of WAM, the Emirati news agency, it all stresses on the word strategic partnership with Israel. The main thing that I see, the main benefit, other than the benefits of high tech technology and so many fields that we can work together.
So, Loai, when are we going to see you coming to Israel? Have you been here yet?
So I never told this anyone, but inshallah, I'm planning to come in Pesach.
Oh, that's exciting. So we're looking forward to that. Have you been here before?
By heart, yes.
Loai, I got to ask you, where does this passion that you have on a personal level come from? For Israel, you've already thrown out a few Hebrew words, Pesach, Baruch Hashem. Speaking to you before, you threw out some other Hebrew. I mean, where does this come from on a personal place? Why the interest? Why the love for Israel?
It's linked to what I said. I am very interested in the Hatarbut HaYisraelit, you know, the Israeli culture, mm-hmm. and the Israeli history. And to be very honest, I lived with a Jewish family in France in 2010, and from that time on, like, they got me really interested into the heritage, because to be very honest, I love the history of the prophets, of how this story really began. And so whenever you're talking about prophets, you have to study the Tanakh, or the Hebrew Bible. Not study it like you go to a school, but you know, you have to be more knowledgeable about it. So it really got my attention, and it really got my heart to it. And this is why when I sent the message, I sent the message last night on my social media in Hebrew to welcoming Naftali Bennett, and I said that we let us all may the prophecy of Isaiah become true. You know, when Isaiah said lo yasa goy el goy harev, nation shall not lift up sword against nation, they shall learn war no more. I wish that we are living these days, inshallah. And this is the truth, to be very honest. Yaakov, I love your name, by the way. Your name will never be Yaakov anymore, but Israel. You know this in Genesis. So it really comes from my for my love.
Very good. That was a good one right there.
that comes from my for my love for the Israeli the judges and the prophets and the heroes. And this is why when I held the lighting of the Hanukkah, and so many people said, "What are you doing?" You know. The history of the Hanukkah, the story of Yehuda HaMaccabi and the Seleucids who were occupying the land of Israel, and then they were provoking the Jews and got a statue of Jupiter into Beit HaMikdash. You see, we have lots of things to educate the Arab generations about Israel and about the history of Israel. And this is what really got me so intrigued and interested in Israel.
And I know you've gotten some like blowback on social media from some of these things. What do you respond to people who are critical of your efforts to strengthen ties with Israel?
Be patient. I would never fight back in a way that would. I'm not here to fight. You know, I'm here to fight with knowledge. That's great, but I don't get into these kind of battles like fighting back, cursing and stuff like that, because I receive lots of curses from so many people. And I say that we need to educate them. We need to educate. Lahab, let me be very honest with you. I was raised with an idea that all the Jews are bad. All the Jews are evil. And the moment I went to France, I was having this idea. But when I lived with a Jewish family and I started to get to know more about Judaism and more about the Jews, things changed. So I say to myself always when I receive this hate, man, you've been in their shoes. So just chill, be patient, and try to change them with wisdom. And this is what I'm trying to do. And believe me, Lahab, to be very honest with you, many people are changing. Tonight, I'm going to have a space on Twitter about the history. I'm going to talk about the story of Joshua bin Nun. And this space is hosted by one of the famous history content creators in the Arab world. So you'll see it on Twitter. So people are starting to change when they see the person speaking with knowledge and with an educated and trying to make a progress. It's happening. And believe me, Lahav, and believe me, Yaakov, I see that change happening when people come and ask me on Twitter or everything, tell us more about this, tell us more about that. So they start to get more accepted. And this is my role as a content creator, as a social media influencer, to see the benefits of the Abraham Accords. Yesterday, I was with Avi Berkowitz. Avi Berkowitz, in the Trump administration, he was the engineer of the Abraham Accords. And I told him, Avi, you did a great job. Avi and Jared Kushner, of course, but Avi was the engineer. I told him, Avi, you made a miracle. You brought many people together. And this is in the eye of God. If this is not good in the eye of God, I don't know what is.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing and a really great message that you're bringing to people. So thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much.
And we hope to see you soon in Israel and on Pesach. We look forward to breaking matzah together.
Be'ezrat Hashem, inshallah. Nitra'e bekarov, be'ezrat Hashem.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please share it with your friends and family. We're available on all the major podcast platforms, and we'll be back next week.